welcome to the latest episode of Techish. We are your hosts. I'm Abadesi, and I'm joined by
Michael Behane. Woo, woo.
Woo. So, Michael, what has been going on in the world of tech this week?
You know what? I don't know. Let's find out.
You tell us, listeners. Well, I'm going to start with a really interesting, kind of nerdy story. We've heard a lot of talk about black holes in the world.
Right.
Especially if you're a fan of sci-fi films like I am.
Yeah.
Christopher Nolan, Interstellar, who's with me, yeah?
I didn't like that film, you know, actually.
What?
Yeah, you know what?
Why?
I thought it was really fun, and then at the end, it was like, the whole answer was love, and I was like, I just can't, no. Like, this is too much. You can't give me some great sci-fi film.
Cynical.
And then, like, the answer is love. That was the key to the universe.
I'm love like, could be a dimension. You don't know that.
Anyways, let's move on. So let's talk about black holes.
I actually saw that at the Royal Albert Hall.
Right.
Sir Stephen Hawking's RIP was on stage. Alongside with like...
Hold on, he was on stage. He's
yeah.
Dead, he's passed away.
In the past.
Okay,
obviously.
Cool. Right,
I'm not sure if you know how time works, but basically it's... Michael is looking at me
what
like,
kind of demonic scientific thing is this? Bring a man back from the dead.
That was a rinse, dude. That was a rinse.
Go on, so explain
so
it.
In the past, while he was still alive.
Right, okay. Got it. Yeah.
The whole of the cast, Jessica Chastain. What's that guy that's like...
Matthew McConaughey.
Matthew McConaughey. Yeah, he was there. But the British guy, the old guy, Alfie, original Alfie.
Oh, Michael Caine.
That's it, Michael Caine.
Michael Caine.
That's a chap.
You have to say my and then cocaine. My cocaine.
My cocaine. That works.
Yeah, for what?
So he was there. As is the guy, the you know actual physicist that helped them come up.
Right. With
the Tesseract.
Yeah.
He actually presented a PowerPoint presentation prior to the film starting,
yeah.
And then they did a live score with Hans Zimmer there performing. Anyway, I'm going off topic. Basically, what I think is friggin' awesome is that we have, first time in human history, a picture of a black hole.
Amazing.
Yeah.
Amazing.
So they're real.
Confirmed.
We knew that.
Confirmed.
But now we have a photo too, so that's real. Yeah, it's already on my Instagram.
Is it heading towards Earth? Are we safe? Nah, but you know what? Black holes are so sick because, like, at one point, they were just like a theory that. When I say, theory is quite confusing because in science, when you say theory, it means it's not. When we say theory colloquially, it means hypothesis. It means, I have an idea of something. A scientific theory is very much a proven thing. So people will be like, oh, evolution is a theory. Like, well, so is the theory of gravity. Jump out of a window, see what happens, basically, right? Yeah. But Einstein hypothesized black holes. So it was just a thought in a guy's head based on maths. Mm. And the fact that now, however many years later, we can actually see the human
evidence.
Eye, photographic evidence.
It's amazing.
Shout out to science.
Whoop.
Science!
There's also been some very, very exciting news for people like me that like Netflix and also the Beyonce, which is that Beyonce's new movie, Homecoming, which features footage from her famous Coachella performance.
Beychella.
As well as other candid shots, new stories of like the, you know, the story behind the performance and all that, dropping exclusively on Netflix 17th April.
Everybody's guest.
Beehive.
Right? Are you part of the Beehive?
Yeah, of course. I'm part of the Beehive. I'm part of ReNavy.
Is that Rihanna's thing?
I think so.
ReNavy. You just made that up.
That's the hashtag.
Okay, all right, cool.
It's definitely Rihanna Navy
because
I think that was her first perfume.
I see.
What other collectives am I a part of? Everything.
Everything.
Most of them.
All of them.
Yeah, basically.
Any black woman, like, that's just got
I'm
a mic.
I'm a believer.
Yeah, man.
Why not?
Anyways. But to me, the most interesting Beyonce story of the week was that whole Reebok situation.
Yes.
Where she bopped out at a meeting.
Let's dive into that.
Tell
us more.
So, I don't know much more. So, basically, so I think she was looking to do, like, some kind of brand deal with Reebok. And
yes.
I think even Under Armour had made a bid. And I think she went to the meeting and essentially she didn't see any black or brown faces. And she bopped out. She's like, this is a disgrace. Like,
nice.
And I think she just kind of was like, yo, like, fix up. I'm not working with you lot. I think there's much more details than that we don't know. I'm sure there was some kind of conversation, like, related, you know, beyond that. But I think she was like, yo, you guys don't get it. I'm off. We were talking off mic, though. I kind of said my feeling towards it. And I think I'm channeling my inner Nipsey Hussle here. I'm just so big now on just, like, ownership.
Yes.
And I was saying to you, like, listen, Kylie Jenner is a billionaire. And obviously, we could say the reason why she's a billionaire, you know, all the privileges and all the helping hand that she had from her family and, you know, white privilege, all that kind of stuff, right? But Beyonce is a much bigger brand as an entity. Beyonce could easily, you know, spin off multiple billion-dollar, you know,
product lines.
Product lines and companies. Like, and I think we still have that mindset of like, how do we partner? How do we work with, you know, Reebok? How do we work with this entity? And it's like, F Reebok. And I don't mean that personally to Reebok. I mean, like, Beyonce, you're bigger than Reebok. You're bigger than, as a brand, Beyonce is bigger than Reebok.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? Like, I mean, I get it. Reebok has the infrastructure. They have the factories. They have everything, right? But Beyonce could raise like an ungodly amount of money with two phone calls. Do you see what I'm saying? And I'm just like, and it's what Jay was doing with Tidal.
Yes.
And I don't use Tidal. And I'm that's one of the things that I'm upset about myself. I really should support Tidal. Because don't get twisted, Jay's a guy from Marcy Projects and he's competing with Apple.
Yeah.
Don't get it twisted. Like, that's a big effing deal. He's a former drug dealer, right? Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like, and he's competing toe-to-toe with Apple.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Big public, giant corporations. And I think that's the model. We've just got to think bigger, because like, we can't expect to keep going into these rooms that weren't built for us and expecting it to represent us completely. It's never going to happen.
I hear you. The reality is, it isn't, I don't know, it's risky basically is what I'm trying to say. Like, you don't know what level of risk she wants to take or what level of like stress and, you know, wahala, as we call it in Africa, she wants to put herself through just to earn some money. Because, you know, brand partnerships,
they can be lucrative. I'm not denying that.
Right? And like, that's a completely different level of like entrepreneurship and like putting yourself out there.
Right,
and,
yeah.
You know, she's a mom. She's got kids. And like, I think they absolutely should do that. But then there's also no rush. Like, as soon as they drop anything, I'll support it. I mean, Beyonce could friggin' start a line of condominiums and I'd probably invest in one.
And that's the point that I'm making, though. Is that Beyonce could release anything and it could be owned by Beyonce and we'd all still support it. I get it. Look, don't get twisted. If you're
maybe she'll just drop some surprise line. She's already pulled back Ivy Park after the allegations.
That Sarah Phillip Green. I don't know about this.
So the Topshop boss, you know, turned out to be another Me Too friggin' offender.
Right, you're right. Yeah.
So as soon as that dropped, she was just like, "Nah, I'm out."
Yeah.
Obviously.
Yeah.
So maybe she's gonna debut her own independent fashion line. Who knows? Who knows?
Yeah.
Who knows?
You're right.
Also, like, I think, you know, we have to remember that there is like a certain risk appetite that comes with entrepreneurship. And it is easier to take those risks if the society in which you're operating and existing in is set up to see you succeed.
Of course, you're right.
And the truth is, you know, how many times has Beyonce been lightened up in magazine shoots?
Right.
Or like, you know, blondified.
Right.
Or, you know, whatever. Like, you know, this is America. I mean, we're in London right now, but like, we're talking about America. And the fact remains, you know, if Kylie Jenner was black, would she have become a billionaire? So I think quickly.
And this is the thing. There was actually...
Or came from a black family. And we know if the Kardashians were black, they would not have a TV show and they would not be famous. They'd be in jail.
And it's not even necessarily... I mean, like, end of the day, like, no black woman with a sex tape is going to be rewarded the way Kim Kardashian was rewarded.
That's what I'm talking about.
That would be completely spun in a different direction. You're ghetto. You're, you know what I'm saying? You're trash, like, you know what I mean? You're
double standard.
Yeah, it's a double standard, right? I'm not denying any of that exists. But... I don't know, man. I think since Nipsey passed and I've been watching a lot of his videos, I've just been more adamant and just been more like, I get that all those structural impediments are there, but...
Still try.
We've got to try.
Yeah.
We have to. Because that whole situation with Phillip Green, that happens when you partner and you're partnering with snakes. You don't realize it.
That's
true. This partnering thing.
Independence.
Independence. Mm. Like, we can do it. Like, we can. It's hard. And it's going to... There's many things in our way, but like... Yo, like, what, are we just going to throw in a towel? I wouldn't do this podcast if I thought it was hopeless.
That's
true. You see
what
I'm saying? Like, this is an independent podcast. Like, we've got to try it. Anyways.
Courage. You know what? Like, one thing I'll say on that. I've been reading again a really good book by Brené Brown called Daring Greatly.
Right.
And she takes the quote, Daring Greatly, from a speech that I think it's Roosevelt that did it. The Man in the Arena speech, it's often called.
Okay. I don't know it yet.
Which is basically this idea that it shouldn't be the critic that we give our attention to.
100%.
It should be the person, you know, the man in the arena, woman in the arena, non-binary person in the arena, who's there fighting tooth, nail, blood, sweat, tears, exposing themselves and putting themselves out there at risk of failure, at risk of criticism. And I think what I'm kind of realizing is how important courage is.
Yeah.
And we're not really often celebrated for taking courage because, like, one of the most common consequences of courage is failure.
Completely.
If you're brave enough to take a risk, you're probably going to fall.
Completely.
Especially if you're underrepresented and especially if systems work against you. So I guess what I'm trying to say is, like, yes, 100%. Let's keep that Nipsey spirit alive and keep hustling. But let's also remember that when we see our people out there doing stuff, we play a role in supporting them. Like,
completely,
we are active in that. You know what I mean? Like, we have to put our money where our mouth is, too, because that's how capitalism works. So I wanted to bring some attention to a tweet that I saw going kind of viral in my Twitter sphere.
Twitter.
And her name is Bethany.
Shout out to Bethany.
She's a people-focused engineer. She's the founder of Compass, which is kind of like an HR analytics platform for what I can see. She's also one of the founders of Project Include.
Dope.
And we know Tracy and obviously big fans of Ellen Powell as well.
Everybody check out Project Include.
Please check out Project Include. So she wrote this tweet. I am so done with culture fit as the go-to excuse when companies haven't hired employees from underrepresented groups. Company culture isn't a fixed state.
Mm.
If an organization is comprised of a homogenous group of people, those were choices.
Completely.
Choose to be better.
Completely.
Discuss.
I mean, we're saying off mic yet again that, you know, culture fit is a polite form of racism, essentially. I mean, I don't necessarily think the people that say that realize that they're being racist. I mean, it depends how negative you want to look upon it. I think
it's
a type
of discrimination because, know, it can apply to not only race, right? It can might apply to your disability.
Or someone that's working class, maybe. Or
exactly,
something, right,
your socioeconomic background. Maybe even how you dress. Maybe even your hair color.
Right, yeah. Completely, yeah.
Like, I've heard someone saying that, like, they've worked in places where you're only allowed to have your natural hair color.
Yeah, that's wild.
I'm just like, what? How does that impact perform? Okay, anyway, please continue.
I just think it's just a polite form of discrimination or racism, whichever way you want to focus on. And it's just effing stupid, basically. And it's coming from companies that are claiming on the outside that they want to try and do diversity correct. And it's like, well, if you're saying that you don't fit into the culture, I don't even know what happened. You take over because I'm so frustrated. It's so obviously stupid that it's like, I don't even know where to even take it. Like,
I think one of the things that I always say when this conversation comes up is, especially with companies that I've worked with in the past, think about everyone who you've rejected because of culture fit and what do they have in common? Or rather, what is different about them to you? Because until you ask that question, people can still take refuge in the idea that it was something, you know, purely objective or values driven or culture driven. But until you really kind of put it under the microscope a bit and say, okay, you know, let's think of the last 5, 10, 15 people who you rejected because of culture fit. What trends are you identifying? And the trends that they identify are, oh, they were women, or, oh, they were, like, you know, from this underrepresented background, or, you know, they were from this university. All of these sort of, like, structural barriers that we often talk about when we're doing the work of intersectional feminism, or we're doing the work of, you know, calling out privilege and stuff, are suddenly exposed. Because you're like, oh, right, so what, you're saying that it's not a fit within your culture to hire people who haven't graduated from an Ivy League background. Oh, no, that's not what we're saying at all. I'm like, okay, but you rejected them because of that. Or you'll be like, right, so you're saying it's not culture fit to hire a woman or a black person or a non-binary person or some, you know, LGBT person, a trans person, a queer person. And they're like, no, that's not it. And I'm like, but then how come everyone, and it's not funny, I'm laughing out of desperation.
Right.
It's not
hilarious.
How come everyone that falls into that bucket all seem to be sharing this common theme of not being the status quo?
And I actually genuinely don't know what it means. As in, I feel like it's just a catch-all phrase to describe somebody who might rock the boat a bit. So you might be in an interview and someone says, well, you know, diversity is important to me. I want to know, like, what are we doing in terms of inclusion? Like, what do you value? Someone asks, if I asked you in an interview, like, what do you value? You might say those things. And then them, I'd be like, oh, this person's going to rock the boat. Culture fit is a problem. And, like, those kind of things just get put under the umbrella of culture fit.
Yeah.
But I don't understand. Maybe I'm being stupid. I genuinely don't understand what it means. Like, I would love to have a HR person who's in charge of, who's ever used that as an excuse. What do you mean? They don't work hard? They don't have skills? What are you trying to say here? You're not going to get along with people. Is that what you're generally trying to tell me? I'm not going to get along with people in the office. You don't know that. How do you know that? Who are you to determine who I'm going to get along with? You don't know me. Get out of here, man. I'm pissed. The more I think about it, I'm just like, yo, that is so stupid.
I kind of want to flip it around, though. Like, truthfully, like, I actually am curious to know, well, two things. One, have you ever not got a job? Let's say you got through all the other rounds.
Right.
And then at the last hurdle, you're told, you know, it wasn't the right culture fit. If you are, I want to hear from you genuinely what the justification was for that. Like, what the evidence was for that. And the second thing is, if you are using Culture Fit, like, because I'm curious, maybe someone has created an objective measure of Culture Fit.
This is what I'm saying. Yeah, I don't get it. Right, yeah.
I haven't seen it, but I'm curious. Like, seriously, I'm curious. Like, if you are out there as a hiring manager and you've, like, I genuinely use Culture Fit and I believe in this, I want to hear from you.
Yeah, there we go. I want to hear from them. I don't even want to hear from people that have been told that they're not Culture Fit because it's not their fault. I want to know from the people that are saying Culture Fit, what the hell do you mean? And explain it. And if you want to write us an email anonymously and say, yo, to be honest, we just use that just as a quick exit, you know, as a polite way of saying you weren't good enough, but, you know, we just don't want to say that to you, like, then fair enough. But I'm genuinely baffled.
The reason why I'm curious why, you know, who's actually received it as a reason is because I feel like I'm going to see those common themes there again. But anyway, let's see what the data shows.
So yeah, you know, like, I read an article called For Nipsey Hussle and Rap's Thriving Middle Class, Staying Too Close to Home is Dangerous. So essentially it's in the New York Times, and they're talking about someone like Nipsey who passed away in his own hood. And a lot of rappers do pass away in their own hood, or they're killed, you know, forget pass away, they're murdered in their own area that they grew up in. You know, once you've made it to a level where you have such wealth, you know, it's dangerous pretty much to be around people that you grew up with, unfortunately. So I mean, most of us listening to this now probably, hopefully, you know, are not growing up in areas that are equivalent to Crenshaw and you know, Compton and that. But there is an element that does ring home true to me, in the sense that I've been around rich people, and I was mentioning this to you before, and, like, I can tell they're uncomfortable being around me just because, like, I'm not as rich, and, like, we might be going out to eat, and I'm not really looking to be ordering the $500 lobster or, you know, the $2,000... you know, filet mignon, whatever. And, like, I get
why... Where the hell did you go?
Listen, no, listen.
It was a $2,000 steak.
It felt like $2,000 to me at the time. It felt like two grand to me. Okay, when I saw the price, I was like, rah.
You're talking shillings
back
in Uganda.
Yeah, basically. And I was just like, you know what? Like, when that happened and I saw how awkward they were when they realized that I was kind of poor compared to them, yeah? Like, I get why rich people just want to hang around rich people, because it's just like, that guilt is just not there.
Yeah.
And, like, you can just be yourself. And... not that I'm sympathizing, like, overly sympathizing with them, but I guess it's just that dichotomy where if you're listening to this podcast and one day, you know, God willing, you sell your company for $1 billion, like, it's going to be hard for you to go back to the projects, or if you're in the UK to your council estate, like, it's just, you just can't go back, unfortunately. And you might want to give back, but
you could live there.
You can't live there.
But that's poverty. Like, let's face it, like, some of us are not that far away from poverty, and no one chooses to live at that level. Like, no one wants to be, you know, necessarily, like, in those environments by choice, struggling to make ends meet by choice. The minute we escape, look, you're the one that posted that thing on Instagram where amazing Hispanic guy.
Oh, right. Yeah. He bought off, he sold his app.
There we go.
And he paid off his parents' mortgage. And they were like, they were crying.
Now that is a level of financial freedom that very few people from our communities are ever going to experience in their lifetime. To be debt free.
Yeah.
Are you serious? As a black or brown person?
Yeah.
Like, especially in America, where, like, generational wealth for black people is, like, close to nothing.
Yeah.
We already talked about it in the past, how, like, the average white household is, like, 10x
yeah.
in wealth. So I think, you know, what that article is, like, highlighting is the fact that, you know, by virtue of this incredible talent within the community, we have this thriving, you know, collection of artists and entertainers who have elevated into a new socioeconomic status.
Right.
And it's incredible. But the reality is that the proportion of people doing that respective to the rest of their community is small, and the rest of their community are left behind. And yeah, like you said, like, I mean, Kanye says he's going back to Chicago, but it's not like he's going to be living in the projects or anything like that.
And that was Nipsey's fault. Nipsey was, his businesses were literally right in the area he grew up in. He used to sell, like, and hustle outside of the block where his stores eventually became. And then he bought the block. But anyways, yeah, you know what? It's something that I wrestle with, because the first story I gave about being feeling poor and being around wealthier people, it's something that I wrestle with, because I'm in this in-between stage now where, and I haven't spoken about this before on the podcast, but, like, you know, I knew people that died in Grenfell Tower. Most of my friends grew up in Council House, which is basically, like, the projects in America. But at the same time, I'm also rubbing shoulders with people raising millions of dollars and, like, you know, people that have VC funds with hundreds of millions of them. And it's like, I'm caught in this in-between stage where, like, I can't forget the people that I know and where I come from, but I'm not rich enough to be like, I can leave or whatever, right? So it's just, it's difficult. We're all going through it. And I think this goes for anybody who, you know, grew up in a single parent household or whatever, whatever, and then they went to university and all of a sudden now they're kind of like the middle class person in their family. And everybody can kind of relate to that, you know, because then you still know people who your cousins or, you know, people that you grew up with that are living a whole different life, and it's not nice and it's not great, and you want to help them, but you can't help everybody.
I think what I'd also add to that, I mean, my thoughts to Grenfell Tower, like, let's not forget that people are still out there, like, suffering. But the proximity to wealth that we face, particularly in tech, I think is quite extreme.
Mm.
And, you know, we've already touched on this idea of, like, being underrepresented, not having as much privilege. But the reality is, you know, if you're in a startup, you're like, oh, wow, these founders have raised X millions.
Mm.
But I'm still staying at my mom's house.
Right, yeah.
Right? And that is the reality of this tech world. Like, you're so close to money.
Yeah.
Even though you don't necessarily have any yourself. And I think really difficult. You know, I remember being, you know, at team events where we're dropping like $2,000-$3,000 on a friggin' night out.
Yeah.
And I'm just like, whoa.
Yeah, that is
crazy. That is our budget for entertainment. Like, one of the first Groupon Christmas parties, like, after our IPO, I'm talking 6 figures easily spent. There was like live acrobats at casino. We hired Village Underground. And, you know, tech is a very privileged world.
Right,
it's a very privileged world. So, you know, any sort of like entrepreneurship, high risk, high reward environment, tech, entertainment, similar parallels, you just catapult into the stratosphere of money.
Right, yeah.
In a very short period of time sometimes.
Completely.
Or even if you're not the owner of the capital, you're still operating near the people who are. And I think that it feels so jarring.
Yeah. And I think that's why I love the work of BB Founders. And it reminds me of a quote that a friend of mine tweeted, Samuel. He basically was saying that these people, and I think he's referring to like VCs and the tech, you know, Illuminati, they don't understand how impactful a lifestyle business is to us. Because when you have a traditional VC-backed business, you're waiting for that one liquidity event. And if you're growing up in poverty or relative poverty, or you're not, you know, well off, you can't wait 3 years for a liquidity event. A lifestyle business that's paying you hundreds of thousands per year is life changing. And to a VC, that's like, oh, that's nothing. That's nothing to ask. Like, who the hell cares about that? So, yeah, it's really interesting. Everybody read the article. I'll put it in the show notes. So let's talk about Lyft, actually. So we did briefly talk about the Lyft IPO last week, but the audio never made it out, actually, into the general public. I've effed up. You don't recollect. Anyways, I'm moving on. So anyways, let's talk about the IPO now, starting from scratch.
What were we talking about? Oh, we're talking about all the people going to be millionaires.
All the people that will be millionaires.
Whoop, whoop. Yourself included. Dinner's on you, baby.
I wish.
Oh.
So the article I read was basically saying that all the people, or most of the people that are going to make money from this, were already rich.
Mm-hmm.
As in, like, the top five equity holders are like people like Andreessen Horowitz, Alphabet, aka Google, General Motors,
yes,
like Fidelity, and so it's like, this is not, you know, some massive transfer of wealth. This is wealth to wealth transfer, if that makes any sense.
Rich gonna get richer.
Rich gonna get richer. Like,
that's what they're good at.
That's the best. That's the.
That's what they do best.
That's what they do best, kind of
all
thing.
All you rich people out there,
shout out to you. Give us money, please.
Anyway.
So what do you think? Lyft, is it a long-term buy? The stock? It's gone down already.
The share price has tumbled.
Slightly.
A little bit.
Right.
But I remember this roller coaster after the Groupon IPO, because I was like locked in, couldn't sell my shares for like a year. And I just remember like every day that it fell, I was like, oh, like you do the calculation and you're like, oh, okay, I can't afford that house anymore. Maybe I can afford this. By the time I left, I could afford like a return flight. I said before, transportation and the data that comes with participating in that space is huge. I'm not saying everyone is going to be, you know, Uber and, you know, go into everything from eating to payments to whatever.
Mm.
But I think there's still a lot, there's still a lot of room for Lyft to expand.
Right.
And, you know, I actually prefer the customer experience of Lyft quite significantly. And
versus Uber.
Yeah. And we were talking about this earlier. What's the book that you brought in?
You lost me.
The One Man Business book.
Oh, The Company of One by Paul Jarvis.
Okay,
yeah. I'm just reading it now. Right. Yeah.
So you told me, I'm quoting the book you're reading. That's hilarious.
Memories.
Basically, do one thing, you know, do the thing that you do very, very well. And by creating those positive customer experiences and consistently delivering on quality, your customers become your advertising channel and, you know,
right,
et cetera.
Word of mouth, yeah.
So what I'm trying to say is, like, what I feel Lyft have done very well, you know, they didn't succumb to that pressure of expanding internationally very quickly. They were they just doubled down on enhancing the customer experience. And I'm friends with a Lyft engineer, actually, so maybe my opinion is a bit biased, but it was kind of cool being in New York with him and another friend taking a Lyft and him almost doing like a little like user interview, like, oh, so like, you know, how do you find the responsiveness of the app?
Mm.
You know, are you, you know, getting accurate location information? Are you doing this? Are you doing that? And then the guy was just like, wow, you're like super curious. And he's like, oh, okay, yeah, I work for the company. That's why. And he was like, oh, okay. Yeah, cool, man. But I just found that, I just found that really interesting. So I definitely, you know, invest. I haven't, full disclosure, but you know, I would, and I'd speak highly of it. I think, I mean, what are your takes?
I'm a pass on the Uber. Pardon me.
I said Uber. Fruity slip.
No, I'm not waiting. I think it's ride sharing as a category will do well. Ride sharing as an individual business, I'm not bullish on. I think the network effects aren't there, and I think once self-driving comes in, anybody's going to be able to come in and just and take over the market.
But, okay, Snapchat,
right,
or Snap Inc. as it's now known. It IPO'd a number of years ago, and now, you know, at the time we were talking about photo sharing and social media, but if you think about it, it's becoming a B2B advertising company. It's created hardware. So it's also about like, what, you know, you have to look to the future when you're thinking
I don't think it's got a bright future, to be honest.
Advertising is huge.
This is what I'm saying. There's a difference between the category advertising, mobile advertising, and category self-driving is going to do great. But that doesn't mean that that individual company will be a winner. Cause I mean, Snapchat has just been robbed by Facebook of all its features. Most people I know have left Snapchat or don't use it as much. Instagram has completely cloned all that stuff. With Lyft, yeah, like I said, I think it just hasn't got the network effects, and I think your self-driving will just absolutely destroy it.
Self-driving is so far off. Even Ford today just announced, I mean, we're recording this, Wednesday, the 10th of April.
Right.
They announced that they're like hitting the brakes on some of their development of autonomous vehicles. I mean, that's still a long way off. You might be right. At least 10 years.
You're right. But I think even like Lyft isn't profitable now, and I don't know if the price point that we as the consumers are used to for all ride sharing, whether that's sustainable, the unit economics doesn't really make sense. It's kind of just like a loss leader and to get us all on the platform. And then whether we'll stick with the platforms once the prices double or whatever in order for them to become profitable, I don't know.
Okay.
One thing I wanted to bring up actually, as a aside from the actual business model. So I saw a tweet where, I forgot the lady's name, I apologize. I don't have the tweet in front of me, but she said she had a really bad experience in a Lyft where she was getting taken home. And this is not personal to Lyft. This could be related to Uber and all ride sharing. So she was on her way home, and the Lyft driver was kind of like, "Oh, so what? You like, do you live by yourself? Like, do you have a boyfriend?
Ooh.
Is anybody at home?"
Oh, God.
And like, you know, then the door was locked, and then like she kind of had to like force her way out and you know run to safety. She complained to Lyft, and essentially they were like, "You know, we'll have a word. We'll find him something, some really slap on the wrist type thing."
Yeah.
And that's quite a common story. I've heard that from a lot of like women who use ride sharing apps. And I feel like there is an element where a lot of these companies are just like, let's just onboard any driver and let's not necessarily worry about, you know, safety. Mm. This is not a website. This is an app that we use that in the real world that gets us from places from A to B.
Yeah.
And I think I don't want Lyft and Uber, and they may already be, I don't want them to be what we've seen with Facebook and Google and YouTube, where it's like, oops, we broke democracy. Oops. Like, you know, people have got hurt now because we were, you know, prioritizing growth. It's already happened, I know. But now these companies are public. Maybe I'm talking fairy tales here, but like something needs to change. I don't know. Have you ever had that experience?
I've had that experience so many times, but you know, to some extent, this is why feminism is so important, right? Particularly intersectional feminism, because the reality is, you know, Uber and Lyft, they do their standard checks, they do their checks, security checks, background checks, etc. But if a guy still finds it totally appropriate,
right,
to hit on a woman who's ultimately in a transactional relationship with him, I am the customer, you're the service provider,
right?
Let's keep it clean, let's keep it, you know, professional. That's a societal problem as far as I see it. You know, I've gone into Lyft before and the driver's like, "Oh, where are you doing? You're visiting. Oh, you're so beautiful. You're so beautiful." And I'm like, "No, you're making me feel uncomfortable, actually." I'm like, "Oh, sorry. You know, I'm just trying to be nice. You know, I just think you're beautiful." And I'm like, "Okay, I'm married. I'm this." You know, whatever
the backstory, the fake backstory. Yeah.
I'm wearing a chastity belt. Like, but, you know, jokes aside, even this week I had someone who was just like, "Oh, I want to get to know you. You're so interesting. Wow. You're so this." And when people say that, I'm like, so you say this to every woman that gets in your car, clearly. And like, no. I swear I don't. And like, I just try to make it kind of funny, but then right, also yeah. impress upon them, like, you know, I'm happy to make a joke about it, but someone else might not really find this funny yeah. because it is a bit inappropriate. But, you know, I shouldn't also have to do that labor of educating them. So, I mean, yes, of course, we don't want these things to happen, and the companies need to do their due diligence and take accountability for it. But I guess I'm also just imploring society at large.
Or men at large, fix up.
You know what I mean?
I'll talk to my people, but I think... next week's meeting. But the thing is, I was going to say, I don't think there's anything wrong per se with what you said, but I think what has to happen is that these platforms have to throw those people off the platform. And I don't think they
right,
do
but
that.
How do we
I
do
don't
the policing?
Think they do that.
So, for example, that guy asked me, am I married? Oh, he right. wants to get to know me.
Yeah.
And like, I'm kind of in a competition with my friends right now to keep my Uber score quite high.
So now it's
like, okay, do I give him a bad rating?
So,
like, what would you do?
I personally think he should get a bad rating.
What rating would you give him?
I'd give him a one or a two or a zero, and I would probably complain because at the same time, no, hold on, could you imagine? Yeah. End of the day, you are in a transactional relationship. It's work essentially for him.
Yes.
So if I'm going to like pitch a meeting. At a tech company now, trying to get them to use the Pocket platform. And all of a sudden, the person I'm pitching is like, oh, you're very handsome. Like, are you single?
Yeah, in, yes.
No, I wouldn't be like, I'd be like, I have a girlfriend, which I do, yeah? So I would be like, yo, this is so inappropriate. Mm. This is so inappropriate. Like,
you'd say it.
Yeah, I'll be like, yo. No, I mean, maybe I'd feel it. And maybe if I was a woman, maybe I would say it. And maybe if I was a woman, I wouldn't say it because I'd be afraid to come across in a, you know, a negative way. Do you know what I'm saying? The joke answer would be, yeah, I'm trying to make that sell. So whatever, if it goes. But obviously,
like, it's just...
be like, that's a bonus. Anyways, so like, no, in all seriousness, like... They should get a bad rating at the least, and they okay. should be thrown off the platform because you shouldn't be chatting up people, trying to like get numbers and holler at people when it's work. Like,
you know what I mean? Like, now I feel so conflicted because I did not give this guy a bad rating. The way I saw it, I was like, okay, he's creepy, borderline, opportunistic, but we've had a conversation. He seems remorseful.
Right. Yeah.
And you know, the conversation has moved on. It's yeah. been shut down.
Yeah.
We've moved on to other topics.
Yeah.
There's no persistence there.
Yeah.
So I was like, I'm not going to hold this against him because also, you know, Uber take 25% of, you know, all of the driver's money. And that's quite a lot. And I'm also kind of just mindful. I don't know. For me, it's kind of like I have to do the like hierarchy of morals
right,
and values
that.
Because I just, yeah, I yeah. always feel torn in those situations,
I mean,
honestly.
Yeah, I get what you're saying.
I don't want to like take money out of someone's pocket. I don't know where they're coming from. I'm very
right.
privileged.
Yeah, just because I get that.
Made a small mistake.
No, I get that. I've had a situation where like an Uber driver, I thought they said a racial slur. And I couldn't tell.
What?
Yeah, I couldn't hear him properly. So I just thought, did he just say what I thought he said? And I was like, oh, you know what? Like, but then if I get this guy thrown off the platform, yeah, like, how's he going to feed his kids? Blah, blah, blah. He can barely speak English.
Yeah.
So I was like, oh, man. But I probably should have said something. And I regret that, to be honest. But, or at least had a word and just been like, yo, that was not good. Like, what are you doing? Fix up. But I get what you're saying in terms of the hierarchy of needs. Because you feel bad. You're like, oh, this might be the only way this person is putting bread on
the
table.
I'm curious what the listeners would do.
You
like, hashtag techish. If you've been in that situation, I want to know.
But I think there should at least be some kind of serious warning system where it's like, well, we've had one woman complain about you making inappropriate remarks, right? Second or third time, you're done. You
yeah,
see what I'm saying,
course.
Right? Yeah,
yeah, definitely.
But I think there's a difference between being made to feel a bit uncomfortable. And in the story I mentioned at the top, the tweet, it was almost like the door was locked,
yeah,
right? And it was like, who's staying at your house right now? To me, that crosses the line.
That's very dangerous.
Because there's a way of inquiring if somebody's single, and there's a way of like
yeah.
going across the line and saying like, who's at home? Nah.
I mean, we live in a world of disproportionate violence against women, 100%. Right? Women are dying at the hands of male partners every day, sadly.
Yeah.
So that is a very real threat.
Mm.
And that's crazy. I'm down for that.
Yeah.
Final point. You mentioned Andreessen Horowitz being one of the biggest winners in the Lyft IPO.
Mm.
So we have to mention their announcement last week.
Go on, shoot.
Or rather, yeah, was it last week? It was last week. So Andreessen Horowitz have decided to make all of their employees financial advisors.
Right, yeah,
and
they changed the model, haven't they?
Could this be the beginning of a trend?
Mm.
So essentially, financial advisors can take bigger risks with greater amounts of capital.
Right.
Andreessen Horowitz, they've kind of been changing the game in the VC world since day one.
Yeah.
And now they continue to do it. What does this mean for VC? What does this mean for founders?
It's interesting. I don't know how it's going to play out. So essentially, they're no longer defined as a venture capitalist. they're going to now be able to take money and put it anywhere, public markets, crypto, whatever, as opposed to invest in early stage startups.
Wall Street. They're going Wall Street.
I mean, I think it's smart. If I give you my money and say, give me a return, and I want you to do it with a technology focus, why does it have to be a startup? Why? You might be able to look at Uber and say that company is grossly underpriced, and I reckon in 3 years' time, it's going to be worth three times as much. So yeah, I mean, it makes perfect sense to me. And let's see what the long-term impact is.
I think what's super interesting about that, we already mentioned BB Founders, but Zebras United as well.
Mm.
I hope what this does is kind of like break the stranglehold that VC seems to have on like access to capital for tech founders.
Right.
It's like, oh, we got to get VC. It's the only way to move forward. And I think if a VC fund is literally saying, actually, we want to be a financial advisor, we're going to move closer to being like an institutional investor, we're probably going to start looking more and more like your investment banks and advisory groups and funds, then that hopefully will make entrepreneurs also start to think, oh, okay, so I don't just have to get venture capital. I can get loans. I can get, you know, all the other myriad of choices.
Do you feel like this is their way of saying that we feel like the opportunities in startups are not as big as they used to be, and that in order for us to get the best returns now, we have to start looking and be really contrarian and start looking at things that are underpriced, like crypto maybe, or public companies? Like, or is that where we're saying, like, listen, maybe startups are getting played out here? Like,
I think it is a land grab. I honestly do. Yeah. I think it's like looking at the chessboard and being like, how do I maximize my space on here?
Right.
And when you've dominated startups and you're like, okay, we project our growth.
Mm-hmm.
Based on staying within this vertical, like, but how do we move quicker? How do we move faster? Like you say, how do we grow the money we're managing and bring up bigger returns? And they're looking at the banks and they're like, yo, we can compete with them. We're more agile. We have different skill sets. We're building our own technology. We started way sooner than they have, maybe more recently. So they have this agility to compete now. And like, if anything, I guess I'd just be worried if I was an institutional investor, because if pension funds start pulling money out of Goldman Sachs and be like, yo, Andreessen Horowitz, let's party. That's big ass money. But then I guess on an individual level, I'm worried, because I guess Andreessen Horowitz like have performed very well, but regardless, you know, not everything they've invested in has performed right, because just can't work like that. So I guess it's kind of interesting to see what will be the impact, at the lowest level, people who are investing their savings and their pensions into these funds. Let's see. Time will tell.
Okay, cool. Let's call it a day from this episode of Techish. Use the hashtag Techish. Leave a review on your app. Say hello to us on Twitter. Use the hashtag Techish, like I said. And have a great week. Look after yourselves and your family.
Take care, guys.
Take care, guys.
And girls.
And ladies. And everybody and possibly. Yeah, everybody.
And dogs and cats and all animals everywhere.
Everybody, we love you. And we'll catch you next week.
Bye.
Ciao.